How many of you are ready for the solar eclipse? I'm not quite ready. I've got my welding goggles. I've got a couple welding helmets that they say should be good to view it with in a box in my garage somewhere. So I just got to find them between now and 2 o'clock on Monday. So it's probably where I'll be later tonight or early tomorrow morning in my garage digging through all that. They say if it's got anywhere between a number 12 and a number 14 lens, if you're familiar with welding, I know Mr. Hammett knows exactly what that means, that you should be good to go. So if not, you might be out of luck at this point. I've just seen some friends on Facebook telling me that they've been trying to get the goggles and things like that, and all the libraries and places seem to be more or less sold out of them. I guess some industrious people are taking the $2 ones they bought from Lowe's and selling them online for $30, which is I think the definition of highway robbery. But at any rate, if you do go out, take a look, certainly be careful and guard your eyes there. Well, along that lines, I'd like to ask you a question. What's an astronaut's favorite candy bar? Mars, or Milky Way, either one, yeah, right, there you go. What's the astronaut's favorite key on his keyboard? Space bar. Oh. What's the definition of a light year? Well, it's the same as a regular year, but it has fewer calories in it. And one last, where does an astronaut park his spaceship? Near a parking meteor. Oh, so you thought they'd get better as they went along, but they didn't, did they? That's a poor segue into today's message, but it's a segue nonetheless. I figured with the coming solar eclipse, there might be people asking questions along the lines of, you know, is there any significance to this prophetically? And I didn't receive a letter specifically in regards to the solar eclipse, but I did receive a PCD, a Personal Correspondence Department letter, some time back regarding the planetary alignment that's going to happen. I think it's September 23rd of this year. I guess several of the planets are supposed to align. And so someone wrote in a question. I work on the PCD team there for church, so people write in letters or emails, and then Terry Eddington will distribute them to the various people who work on the team, and we'll write up a response and send it back for them. So the letter I received went something like this. It says, what is your take on the planetary alignment on September 23rd, 2017? It does fit with Revelation 12. Do you believe there will be extensive flooding with most of Florida underwater and all the U.S. shorelines moving inland 100 miles or more, depending on east or west, etc., with the approach of Planet X, or Nibiru? So the letter I received, and I'm certainly not here to, you know, make fun or chide anyone, but I believe that the person asked this question very legitimately concerned, having questions, said, what's your take on it? They went on to express that they felt, you know, no matter what happened, they understood God would protect them, and that was only where protection came from. But they basically just were looking for an opinion. So I wrote back a letter to them and shared a little bit with you today. But this is the question I really want to ask. What's the reason for prophecy? What's the real reason for prophecy? A subtitle might be this: Heavenly Signs, Run for Your Life? And that's a question mark, by the way, not a statement. Heavenly Signs, Run for Your Life? Question mark. In other words, is the sky falling? In order to really answer this question, we'll have to spend a little bit of time doing some background on what Planet X is, what Revelation 12 is about, and prophecy in general. So we'll spend quite a bit of time kind of laying that groundwork, but let's start with this. Basically, the theory behind Planet X, or Nibiru, as some would call it, it was developed in the 90s. It's not necessarily, it's not, in fact, a scientific theory. It's actually a theory that's been forward by people who feel like they were contacted by aliens and being warned. NASA, astronomers in general say there's nothing to it. But what it says is they feel like there is some other planet somewhere beyond our solar system that we can't see that's on an inevitable collision course for mankind, for the Earth, and it's going to wipe out all of mankind. That's what the theory says, and again, there's no credible scientific proof to show that anything like that is in the works. But that's where the approach this person was coming from. And they were asking, hey, with the planetary alignments that are coming up, could that have anything to do with it? Revelation 12, as we'll see, talks a little bit about signs in the heavens. So let's talk a little bit about Revelation in general. Just kind of a general outline. Then we're going to get into Revelation 12 and see what does Revelation 12 really talk about? And do we need to be running for our lives? To understand the book of Revelation, we need to understand that Revelation is filled with a lot of information. Some of it is quite literal. Some of it is very powerful imagery and figurative in its scope and meaning. The book of Revelation is not completely chronological. Chapters 4 through 11 seem to be more or less chronological. Chapters 15 and 16 and then 19 through 22. But there are several insets in there. And if you read the booklet, the church's booklet, the book of Revelation unveiled, you'll see they have a nice chart that kind of outlines all this. But a quick overview of Revelation would go something like this. In Revelation 1, you have an introductory letter saying that this is a revelation not of John, it was to John, but it's a revelation of Jesus Christ. As we get through the chronological portion here, you'd see it starts talking about the seven seals, the seven trumpets, the seven bowls or plagues that are poured out, the two witnesses, the return of Christ, the battle that's going to go on there, the millennial reign of Christ, the post-millennial rebellion of Satan, and then a new heaven, a new earth. Very, very broad sort of a explanation there, the timeline of Revelation. Inset in that, we have several chapters that kind of aren't tied to any fixed chronological point. For example, Revelation 2 and 3. These actually have, it would seem, perhaps threefold meaning. Seems that they were letters written there to the seven actual churches in Asia Minor, giving them various warnings and instruction. But it would also seem that that could refer to eras or epochs in the church over time, from that time up until the end time. But perhaps the most applicable explanation of Revelation 2 and 3 in those churches is it refers to seven attitudes that we can have as Christians, as we pursue the kingdom, no matter what date we live, there are some attitudes outlined and the warnings that go along with them, the pitfalls of each, except, of course, the Church of Philadelphia. Chapter 13, we read about two beasts, one being referring seemingly to the Roman Empire at that time, which has subsequently fallen, and the second being a revitalization of the Roman Empire, or a new political power that will be on the scene at the end time. We get into chapter 14, and by the way, this is not a really a Bible study on Revelation. I think I'm thinking about actually going through a thorough Bible study on Revelation, maybe when we finish our Bible study series on the fundamental beliefs, but just, again, kind of a quick overview to give us some context before we get into Revelation 12. Revelation 14, we get three messages by the angels brought down. A message to those who have died in the faith. A message to those who are living, trying to keep the faith, us today. And a message to those who would abandon their calling and basically follow that revitalized Babylonian system that we're going to see come and become predominant at the end time. Chapter 17 and 18 describe the false church, what it will look at like, and give kind of some description there of what that church power will look like and its links to the beast at the end time. And amongst these falls chapter 12. Chapter 12 is what our focus is going to be today. And chapter 12 is really a description of the true church, the part of the body that we want to be in. So with that as kind of a broad background, let's go ahead and start in Revelation chapter 12. Let's start in verse 1. I had all this time. You thought I would have turned there by now. Revelation 12, starting in verse 1. I'll be reading from the New King James throughout today. Revelation 12, verse 1, it says, "Now a great sign appeared in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and on her head a garland of 12 stars. Then being with child, she cried out in labor and in pain to give birth." So immediately some might say, see, it's talking about heavenly signs right here. It says it very plainly. And they might try to tie this to a specific event. But can we do that? Can we do that? Do we see us being told exactly what these signs are and that we should try to tie them to a specific event? You know, one of the key to understanding the book of Revelation is understanding what Christ taught about prophecy while here on earth, specifically linking it to Matthew 24, Luke 1, in regards to the Olivet prophecy. So let's turn to Luke 21. Keep your finger here in Revelation 12. We'll be coming back. Let's go over to Luke 21. And see what Christ said in regards when his disciples asked him the question. They said, how are we going to know? They're admiring the temple and all these great physical things. Revelation 21. Verse 6 says that. Verse 7, they ask him, or let's back up in verse 6. So they're admiring the temple, the things going on there. And Christ says, "These things which you see, the days will come in which not one stone shall be left upon another that shall not be thrown down." Of course, we know that the temple was later destroyed in 70 AD. Of course, there's still a foundational wall there, but that's neither here nor there at this point. Verse 7, so they ask him, saying, "Teacher, but when will these things be?" They wanted to know. Can you imagine being standing there with Christ, admiring the temple? You know, this was the center of worship. And Christ, you know, saying, you know what? It doesn't matter. It's going to be torn down. And they're going to say, what? Wait, what are you talking about? When's this going to happen? That's what they ask. And they say, "And what sign will there be when these things are about to take place?" First thing he says isn't the planets will align. There will be a solar eclipse. He doesn't say that. What does he say? He says, "Take heed that you not be deceived. For many will come in my name, saying, 'I am he.' The time has drawn near. Therefore, do not go after them." Later on in Revelation, we're going to read about religious deception, or we actually may not touch on that today, but we know religious deception is the first thing that we have to be on guard for. Christ says that very carefully, very clearly, be on guard that we don't be deceived. When we read the Bible, when we read it word for word, when we understand what Christ says about prophecy, what he did reveal, it's much harder to be deceived than it is if we start adding to it and saying, well, I wonder if this happens, and I wonder if that happens, and could this be a sign that da-da-da-da-da. When we start adding those things to it, we've added a whole lot more information into the mix that's not necessarily true, and we have a whole lot more opportunities for ourselves to become tripped up on. Let's continue to read and see what he says, starting in verse 10. He said, "Nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdoms, and there will be great earthquakes in various places and famines and pestilences, and there will be fearful sights and great signs from heaven." Aha, he says signs. He says there's going to be signs in heaven. But he doesn't say exactly what they're going to be, does he? He doesn't give us that information. Notice, too, what he does say, starting in verse 12, right after he said there would be these things happen, these earthquakes, these heavenly signs. Verse 12, he says, "But before all these things, they will lay their hands on you and persecute you, delivering you up to the synagogues and prisons. You will be brought before kings and rulers for my name's sake. He said there's going to be a time of great tribulation. He actually uses that term over, well, let's go ahead and flip there. Matthew 24. Matthew 24, again, keep your finger in Luke, we'll be coming right back. Matthew 24. Verse 21, Christ says, "For then there will be great tribulation, such as has not been since the beginning of the world until this time, no, nor ever shall be." That's where we get the term, the tribulation or the great tribulation. Christ uses those words there. Luke doesn't record it exactly that way, but Christ says that in Matthew 24. As we go through Luke 21 here, we won't read all over it for the sake of time, verses 13 through 19. We're reminded that no matter what we have to endure, if we lose our lives physically, that in the end, our life really won't be lost. That salvation awaits if we follow what Christ really, truly teaches us here through prophecy. Verses 20 through 24, we read about Jerusalem being surrounded by armies, etc. Picking it back up in verse 25. He says, "And there will be signs in the sun and the moon and in the stars, and on the earth, distress of nations with perplexity, the sea and waves roaring." So here we go. We're reading about signs again, but what is it related to? Verse 26, it says, "Men's hearts failing them from fear and the expectation of those things which are coming on the earth, for the powers of heaven will be shaken. Then they will see the Son of Man coming in a cloud with power and with great glory." So here we're given a little more indication. Not told what the signs would be, but we're told that those are linked to the actual return of Christ. That happens after the Great Tribulation, as we see. It's outlined pretty clearly. So is the subject of Revelation 12 the return of Christ? Doesn't appear so. Revelation 12, we read about the church, doesn't actually mention a return of Christ at that time. Here we see this tribulation will come, after which there will be signs, and then the return of Christ. As we see when we read through Revelation 12, we're going to see this refers much to that tribulation time. So keep that in mind. We'll get to Revelation 12 in just a minute. But just to kind of close the loop a little bit on Christ's statement here in Matthew 24, let's go ahead and connect it to where it is paralleled in Revelation, and that's Revelation chapter 6. Revelation chapter 6. Revelation chapter 6. Let's pick it up in verse 9. This is talking about the fifth seal. It says, "When he opened the fifth seal, I saw under the altar the souls of those who had been slain for the word of God and for the testimony which they held," those who have died in faith. "And they cried with a loud voice, saying, 'How long, O Lord, holy and true, until you judge and avenge our blood on those who dwell on earth?' Then a white robe was given to each of them, and it was said to them that they should rest a little while longer." They're told, not yet. Not yet. It's not their time. You see that connection to that persecution there. Verse 12, he says, "I looked when he opened the sixth seal, and behold, there was a great earthquake, and the sun became black as sackcloth of hair, and the moon became like blood." Now we see something that connects a little closer with what Christ said when he talked about the signs of the return of the Son of Man, when he would return to earth. Verse 13, "The stars of heaven fell to the earth as fig tree drops its late figs when it's shaken by a mighty wind." We didn't read it, but of course, Christ talks about the parable of the fig tree a little bit there in Luke 21. We skipped over that bit. So we see a pretty good timeline established here then. We see that we're told there would be religious persecution. There would be heavenly signs They would be the day of the Lord and the return of Christ. With all that having established our background to the book of Revelation, to a bit of a sequence of events, a timeline there, let's go back to Revelation 12 and get back into what's really being talked about here. Revelation 12, I'm going to reread verses 1 through 2. It says, "Now a great sign appeared in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and on her head a garland of 12 stars. Then being with child, she cried out in labor and in pain to give birth. And another sign appeared in heaven. Behold, a great fiery red dragon, having 7 heads and 10 horns, and 7 diadems on his heads. His tail drew a third of the stars in heaven, and he threw them to the earth. And the dragon stood before the woman who was ready to give birth to devour her child as soon as it was born. She bore a male child who was to rule all nations with a rod of iron, and her child was caught up to God and his throne." I think it's pretty clear from this explanation who this child is. It's talking about Jesus Christ. The dragon, of course, is the serpent, Satan. It says he was killed immediately. Now we know Christ did live 33 and a half years before dying. But I think when we look in terms of prophecy, we have to understand immediately the kingdom didn't come. In the overall time frame of the epochs of time that have happened between Satan's rebellion and when Christ will return and establish the kingdom here on earth, relatively speaking, this was pretty much instant that Satan gobbled up, the dragon gobbled up that child. Of course, we know Satan was very influential. He influenced Herod to try to kill and persecute all those under 2 years when Christ was born. Of course, we know he put it into Judas's heart to betray Christ. So we know that Satan did play a role in that, and it was according to God's plan. But certainly he played a role there. So this is talking about Jesus Christ. When we read about these signs here, the woman, the 12 stars. Does any of that sound familiar? The 12 stars, the sun, the moon? Think back to a prophecy we read back in Genesis. Genesis 37. Genesis chapter 37. Verse 9, we pick up the story of Joseph. It says, "Then he dreamed still another dream and told his brothers, said, 'Look, I have dreamed another dream. And this time the sun, the moon, and the 11 stars bowed down to me.'" Now notice it says 11 stars. Who was Joseph? He was the 12th, right? He was the 12th one in this prophecy given. He says, "So he told it to his father and to his brothers, and his father rebuked him and said to him, 'What's this dream you have dreamed? Shall your mother and I and your brothers indeed come and bow down before you?' And his brother envied him, but his father kept them in mind." Where was Jesus born from in terms of lineage? Came out of the tribe of Judah, right? He came out of Jacob, the man who became Israel, Judah being one of those 12 stars. Revelation 12, verse 1 and 2, when we read about this, we're reading that it's a sign, not of any astronomical event, but that Christ was prophesied to come out of Judah, out of Joseph, out of Israel. It's not about heavenly signs. As we go on, we're going to see Revelation 12, again, talks about the church. Going back then to Revelation 12. We've talked a little bit about the players here that'll be on the scene at this time. But now we're going to get into some of the actions, the things that happen, the things that the true church will be put through basically at the end time. Revelation 12 verse 7, I'm just going to summarize a lot of this. We see war breaks out. Michael and his angels fight, battle Satan. Verse 9, Satan's cast to the earth. Verse 12, let's go ahead and read that. It says, "Therefore rejoice, O heavens, and you who dwell in them. Woe to the inhabitants of the earth and the sea, for the devil has come down to you having great wrath, because he knows he has a short time." Telling those in the spirit realm to rejoice. Satan's been cast out of there. He's out of town. That's good news. He's also being told here, those on earth weep, because now he's come to earth. Verse 13 says, "Now when the dragon saw that he had been cast to earth, he persecuted the woman who gave birth to the male child." We recognize that connection to not just the physical nation of Israel, which is physical nation, the Jews today, there is a connection there. But we understand that's talking about the church, the body of Christ that we're a part of. Verse 14 says, "But the woman was given two wings of a great eagle, that she may fly into the wilderness to her place where she is nourished for a time and times and half a time from the presence of the serpent." To use some church speak, we often refer to this as the place of safety. There's been lots of speculation where that is. Is it a physical place? Who will be there? Time times half a time seems to indicate 3.5 years, just as the tribulation is. But what does it mean for you and I? Will there be a physical place of safety? Could be. But notice what happens, what we're told, as we even read on beyond that. Verse 15 says, "So the serpent spewed water out of his mouth like a flood after the woman, that he might cause her to be carried by the flood." Now, even those that it seems might be nourished away from the presence of the serpent, that doesn't mean life is going to be easy. Satan is still going to be on this earth trying to persecute the church. I think this particular scripture is where the person who wrote the PCD letter kind of tried to make a connection to the flood there, potential flooding that could happen in parts of the U.S. Verse 16 says, "But the earth helped the woman, and the earth opened up its mouth and swallowed up the flood which the dragon had spewed out of his mouth." God is going to protect his people. But, verse 17, "And the dragon was enraged with the woman, and he went to make war with the rest of her offspring, who keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ." Well, it seems some might be preserved. It says some are going to be persecuted. Christ said there would be those who are delivered, those who are martyred. There's a connection here as well, again, with that physical nation of Israel. But there's a distinction made in verse 17. It says those who keep the testimony of Jesus Christ. Do Jews today have the testimony of Jesus Christ? No, they don't. They don't believe what Christ taught. They don't believe what he represented. They don't believe that he was the Son of God. So it seems, while God will protect his people, it may not be easy. And it may not always come in physical protection. It may be spiritual protection so that we are preserved, as we're told in Luke 21, that if we endure, if we die, God still keeps us. He still keeps us spiritually preserved. And that's what we look forward to. That's what we hang our hat on. That's what we keep in mind as we read through any prophetic passage. That's a pretty thorough review of Revelation chapter 12. And it has some difficult things in it to understand. But you know, what's more difficult than understanding the things that we're told there in Revelation 12 is living with what we do understand, what we are told. The person who wrote me this PCD letter, they had a legitimate question. I don't fault them for that. They were talking about the sun, the moon, and the stars, and somehow by the time they got to from verse 1 to verse 15 or 16, they got to the point where they were convinced that there was going to be a flood to, you know, wipe Florida off the face of the map. And they were concerned, do I need to get my relatives out of there, move them, warn them, do things like that. So I tried to encourage them that, you know, we really don't know. We're not given those specific details. It doesn't seem like that's what Revelation 12 is teaching. But I asked them to consider another question. And that was the question I started with today. What is the reason for prophecy? If we can't sit there and correlate the movements of the stars in the sky to tell us exactly the return of Christ, what good is it? When we see heavenly signs, do we need to run for our life? Run for our lives. When we start asking questions about what prophecies mean, what does it lead us? Does it lead us to worrying about, do I need to buy real estate on higher ground? Is California going to fall into the sea? Do I need to buy airfare to go to the Middle East so I can be at the place of safety? Is that where it leads us, or does it lead us to ask another question? I think Peter asked that question very well. Let's turn to 2 Peter chapter 3. And this is the question that I urge this person to ask of themselves. Rather than worrying, rather than wondering, what precisely is going to happen? Because Christ gave us that warning in Matthew 24, we can be deceived. As a matter of fact, hold your finger here in 2 Peter. Let's go back and just finish up how Christ concluded this section in Matthew 24. Verse 4, we read the parallel account on Luke 21, where it talks about let no one deceive you. But notice how he finishes up this in Matthew 24, verse 23. He says, if anyone says to you, look, here is Christ, or there, do not believe it. For false Christs and false prophets will arise and show great signs and wonders to deceive, if possible, even the elect. See, I have told you before. Therefore, if they say to you, look, he is in the desert. Do not go out. Look, he is in the inner rooms. Do not believe it. Christ begins and ends his message about end time prophecy with the warning, don't be deceived. Don't be caught up in theories that people have. Don't let it sweep you off your feet with concern, with worry, and carry you away from the real question. Christ came and taught us how to live, and that's what Peter reminds us in 2 Peter 3, verse 10. 2 Peter 3, verse 10. It seems that Peter was writing this particular epistle, somewhat at least, in response to some concerns that people had voiced to him about the return of Christ, about end time prophecy. And notice what he says, 2 Peter 3, verse 10, he says, but the day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night, in which the heavens will pass away with great noise, and the elements will melt with fervent heat, both the earth and the works that are in there, it will be burned up. Verse 11, and this is one to underline in your Bibles. Therefore, since all these things will be dissolved, some translations say, since all these things will come to pass, what manner of persons ought you to be in holy conduct for godliness? Looking for and hastening the coming of the day of God, because of which the heaven will be dissolved, being on fire, and the elements will melt with fervent heat. So he's saying, because all this stuff is going to happen, Christ told us what was going to happen. Revelation gives us little bits and pieces and clues about it's going to happen. But what's it mean? Why? Why is it important? Verse 11, Peter asks that question. Because it's going to happen, what kind of person should you be? What kind of person should I be? Quite frankly, it's a lot easier to speculate on prophetic events than it is to be a better husband. It's a lot easier to connect, or at least try to connect dots through different scriptures in the Bible, than it is to change my heart, to change my focus from what I want to where God leads me. Peter reminds us, what kind of person are you supposed to be? The Bible simply does not give us all the detail we might like to have when it comes to end time prophecy. We might want to know various things. What does this sign mean? Is there anything to the solar eclipse, to the planetary alignments? We don't know. Our faith, how we live today, it has to be centered not on prophetic events, but on obedience to God and both spirit and truth. John 4:24. The purpose for prophecy is to help remind us these things will come to pass. In the meantime, what am I doing? We should feel motivated, not manipulated, by the course of the sun and those who might try to extrapolate theories from that. We don't run to hide under the rocks, as we know some will, at the return of Christ, hoping that the rocks fall on them to die. We don't run in that sense. But there is a way in which we should run. We read that in Paul's writings. Let's go to 1 Corinthians 9. 1 Corinthians chapter 9. And read verse 24. First Corinthians 9, starting in verse 24. He says, "Do you not know that those who run in a race all run, but one receives the prize? Run in such a way that you may obtain it." We're running all right. But it's not to figure out what these signs mean. It's not to hide under a rock. It's an endurance race. We're running the race set before us, the one that Christ said is going to be tough, because there's going to be deception. There's going to be people try to put stumbling blocks in our way with different theories about what things in the heavens might or might not mean. Paul reminds us we have to endure. We have to finish. Prophecies, again, are motivation. Motivation for us to endure our race. Motivation to finish that race. Motivation to win that race. Hebrews 12, we get quite the spiritual encouragement about running this race. Hebrews chapter 12. Verse 1. Hebrews 12, verse 1. He says, "Therefore, we also, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us." Our job isn't to figure out what these signs mean. Our job is to endure. Our job is to obey the commands, the teachings of the Bible. It's what we strive to. It's what we strive to do whenever we open the Bible. When we open the Bible to study, shouldn't it be to try to figure out when is Christ going to return? We should study and say, what do I need to do? How do I need to be closer to God? How can I be closer to God? How can I focus on that relationship and make deep-seated change in how I live? And how can I honor Him and honor what He teaches me and asks me to do, to obey through His commands? Verse 2, "Looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before Him endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God." We have this encouragement. This race, it's already been won. Our leader, our king, our high priest, Jesus Christ is already there at the throne of God, on his right hand. He's waiting for us to join him. Peter reminded us of this reason for prophecy as well, going back to 2 Peter for just a minute. 2 Peter 3. Peter points back to what it is we're really looking for. 2 Peter 3 and verse 13, picking up where we left off before. After asking what kind of person we should be, knowing that the earth is going to melt with a fervent heat, he says this, "Nevertheless, aside from what may happen, what may come to this earth, nevertheless, we, according to his promise, look for new heavens and a new earth in which righteousness dwell." If we live faithfully, according to what God teaches, according to how Christ directed us, this is the heavenly sign we look for. This new heaven, this new earth. The planet, the existence we worry about today, come a time, doesn't exist. It's a former thing. It will have passed away. So we begin to conclude. Let's turn to Revelation 21. Skip to the end of the story, as it were. Revelation 21. After the events of Revelation 12 have all played out, after the two witnesses have come and gone, seven trumpets, seven seals, seven trumpets, seven plagues have come and gone. After Satan is bound away 1,000 years, we live through the millennium. Satan rebels again. After that's come and gone and already over, we read what happens. Revelation 21, verse 1. It says, "Now I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away. Also, there was no more sea." I always wondered what this would be like. My family's going to Panama City Beach this year for the feast. I love to go out and frolic in the ocean and play on the beach. What's it mean exactly that there will be no more sea? Does it mean literally there'll be no more water? Don't know. Doesn't matter. "Then I, John, saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband." This is the heavenly sign that we look forward to. It's not anything we're going to see on Monday, whether we have a welding helmet or not. This is the heavenly sign we look for. The establishment of eternity for God's kingdom. Verse 7. We get a reminder. Do you want to be a part of this? Do you want to see this new heaven, a new earth? Then remember this. Verse 7, it says, "He who overcomes shall inherit all things." What's not included in all things? "He will inherit all things, and I will be his God, and he shall be my son. But the cowardly, unbelieving, abominable, murderers, sexually immoral, sorcerers, idolaters, and all liars shall have their part in the lake which burns with fire and brimstone, which is the second death." A variety of sinful actions are listed right here. And a reminder that God says, no matter what happens between now and then, what happens in the heavens, when this new heaven, when this new earth, when this heavenly sign, this kingdom that we really seek after comes, those things aren't going to be there then. So they better not be in you now. That's how we run. That's what we run for. We strive to be the people that Christ will have in this new heaven, on this new earth. On Monday, grab your appropriate safety gear if you choose to do so. Go out. Look at the eclipse. Enjoy it. I'm sure it's going to be beautiful. In September, hopefully we have a clear night. We can look up in the sky. See how all the planets align. I'm sure it'll be amazing, a sight to behold. But let this new heaven, let this new earth we read about in Revelation 21, let those be the heavenly signs we seek, the coming kingdom of God. And let's run for our life toward that goal.